podcasts. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome to the Collision. Ooh, do we have a fun show this week here at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM WPFW, where we're trying to change the world one broadcast at a time, where sports and politics collide as well, is the Collision. I'm Dave Zirin. We do the show every week with 11-year NBA vet Etan Thomas, who we will hear later in the show. And of course, I'm joined by the great Chuck Modiano. Before I go to Chuck, let me just tell everybody what's going to happen. Chuck and I have some serious sports and politics mojo to talk about until 10:18. And then Chuck, Dave Z, and Etan Thomas will be talking to an absolute bona fide legend. His given name is Robert Garcia, but I think you might know him as Bobito. A Hall of Fame radio producer and DJ, an amazing person who people don't even know this about the history of basketball, whether you're talking about hip hop or sneaker culture. I mean, just a remarkable life at the center of basketball and hip hop and New York City. And he has a book called Bobito's B-Ball Bang Bang. And Bang Bang is what he would say as a ESPN Deportes basketball announcer. When the ball would go in, he'd go bong bong. But we're going to talk to Bobito about all aspects of his life in a way that only the Collision does. Etan Thomas, Chuck Modiano, Dave Zirin talking to Bobito at about 18 after the hour. And I can't wait for us to unleash that on y'all. But for now, my favorite part of the show, even beyond talking to legends like Bobito Garcia, when I get to chop it up a little bit with Chuck Modiano. How you doing, Chuck?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, DZ?
Man, I'm doing great. Let me throw an issue at you, Chuck.
Yeah.
And then let's talk about that war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu, being in town.
That's right.
And the need to let him know that the only place he belongs in D.C. is in the jail.
That's right.
So that's the only acceptable way I will accept for him being in the DMV is if
that's
he's
right.
being escorted to some kind of a prison. But we're going to get to that in a second. Chuck, the news broke. And I just want to know how I'm going to throw something out here. And I want you to push back on me if you think I'm wrong, because I don't even know what I think. But I'm really wrestling with this. The news broke today that we now have the biggest contract in NBA history. Did you see this?
The biggest contract? Oh, you're talking about Devin Booker?
I am talking about Devin Booker.
Oh, yeah. Like 75 mil a year or something like that. Yeah.
2-year extension, 73, I believe, mil a year.
You're right.
Highest ever. The dude has been, I believe, like just an all-star four times, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, not like a Giannis-style resume. Right. Two MVPs, 50, you know, Giannis, like 50 points in a game six deciding championship game. That's not Devin Booker's resume. I mean, his resume is, I think it's six straight seasons averaging at least 25 a game, something only Giannis has done among current players. You take away folks like Durant for injury years and things like that. Like as far as like full seasons, only Booker and Giannis have done that. So certainly an incredible player. But dude, also a team, and frankly, also a player who, other than when he played with Chris Paul, who is the ultimate, like, I will get you wins player, has never shown an ability to lead a team to winning, has never shown that his style of ball can lead a team to winning. Now, the Paul connection tells me that he could be a part of that as sort of like a kind of like incredible scorer next to the person who knows how to actually orchestrate a game. But Booker on his own, there's no evidence that his style of play lead. That's the first thing. The second thing, and I want to throw this at you, Chuck, this is the part that I think you're going to push back on, and it's okay. I am not sure in this world of crisis that we are in, you know, in a world where people literally cannot afford to live in our cities, I don't know what I think about a basketball player making $73 million a year. I don't know about the morality of that. Now, the argument you and I have always made for years is the money is there. I'd much rather it go to the player than it go to the billionaire hedge fund jerk at the top of the pyramid.
That's right.
That's always been the argument.
Yeah.
But Chuck, we have to admit that that was the argument when dudes were making like $40 million for 4 years. And that was the top player in the league. You know, now we're talking about a level of money that one can even buy themselves easily, like into the ruling class. You know, you take that money. I'll never forget when Len Dykstra during the 94 baseball strike said, well, I own a series of restaurants, so I understand sometimes you have to discipline your workers. So like what, and that was 94 money.
Yeah.
And that was Len Dykstra money. Dude probably made 700K a year, you know, which is very nice, no doubt, but it ain't 73 million a year. So it makes me wonder things, Chuck, about like, what if instead of these high, like 73 million, man, first of all, two things, and then I'll throw it to you. I know I'm going through a lot.
No, go through a lot. And you're right. I'm going to push back a little, but go with it.
I want you to.
Yeah.
The first thing that we have to ask ourselves, because, you know, there's an old expression in politics, sometimes quantity has to equal quality. You know what I'm saying? To use an example of that, like sometimes quantity means quality. Like say you're just somebody who owns like a really nice suit in your closet, you know, and it's just like, oh, you like looking nice in a suit. That's awesome. But what if you say, well, I still own a nice suit, but now I own a men's warehouse. So I have a choice of 10,000 suits, but I'm still the guy who just likes wearing a suit. You might say at that point, well, this is now more than you just owning a suit. You know, this is, you know, it's still a suit, yeah, but the quantity has become a question of the quality of who you are and your life. So the two things are this. One, there's never been a bigger income gap among NBA players. And how fair is that when you've got, think about it, somebody like, how much worse is Gary Trent than Devin Booker? And I'm being serious about this. Undersized guys who can still light it up. What is Gary Trent? Maybe 30% of Devin Booker? Is that fair? 30%? Is that too high?
Yeah.
Gary Trent's got a 1 year for $4 million deal right now.
Right.
1 year, $4 million. Maybe out of the league in a year.
Right.
There's all this talk on podcasts about the death of the NBA quote unquote middle class. and right. players not, you know, because of this something called the second apron with salary caps. I don't really want to go into that because it's really boring. It is artificial. It's a terrible union deal. I'm sorry, but the union did not do a good job. The post Michelle Roberts union, who I loved Michelle Roberts, is not doing the trick. Right. They crushed the middle class. Players now are looking for contracts wherever they can find them. But then you have this layer of players making money that like $600-700 million contracts, things that would have been incomprehensible even 5 years ago. And then the last thing I'll say, Chuck, is so not just like the haves and have nots. And what does that do to the cohesiveness of a team? What does that do to the power structure of a team? But there's this little aspect too, Chuck, that just really, I don't know, rankles in my head, which is like, what would how do we restore a middle class to the NBA, but how do we, how do we make ticket prices cheaper? You know, like people are getting priced out of these games. And so fine, the owners make a lot of profits and therefore the players should make a lot of profits. At what point do are fans in a position of being anything but ruthlessly exploited? So I'm not saying all that money has to come from the players and they should have less salaries. I'm just wondering, is there a way that we can put a ceiling on all of this from ownership, profits, player salaries? I mean, $73 million a year, Chuck. And like, how do we make it so the like working class fans can afford to go to games? And so that weighs on my mind very heavily. So I turn it over to you, Chuck. Yeah. Like, I don't know how comfortable I am. And also, last thing, Chuck, is the morality of the fact that why are players making all this money? Well, let's be honest. It's not the strength of the union, because otherwise there would be better salary structure for everybody. What it is the gambling industry and the billions of dollars that this addictive, regressive tax is putting on fans, which has produced all this revenue that has made owners rich and players rich. And where is there's a morality question in that for me as well, because there's it's a parasitic relationship with the fan in a way that's even more intense than when they say take public money for stadiums. So I'm stopping there, Chuck. $73 million contracts. What's your take?
So I have a lot of takes, and most is pushback, but partly it's going to be pushback because the latter part about, you know, taking your family to a game, I think that ship has sailed. Tell me where you can do that. You can still do that in WNBA. I don't know the sport that you can do that. I don't know the structure you can do that. This is capitalism. Like, we're talking about capitalism, and I don't think changing any of these structures is going to change that greed. So on some level, I'm like, I stopped going to games, you know, a while ago. I see the ticket prices. I mean, certain games. I will go to some Wizards games and whatnot, Mystics games and whatnot. But I just think the ship has sailed. It's wherever you go, the beer is like $18. The hot dog is $15. I don't think it's a runaway train. So there's that. Number two.
Very fair. Go on, please.
Number two is, listen, and this doesn't sound very socialist, but it is. And I am socialist. But if we're going to live in this society, I will go back to the previous argument. Matt Ishba, the owner of the Phoenix Suns, is estimated to be worth $10 billion. That's his net worth, $10 billion. If you took Devin Booker's contract, or you took that $75 million a year, and you multiplied it by 100, you're still not having more than Matt Ishba. So it's like, I do go back to, well, would I rather have Matt Ishba having, or would I rather have Devin Booker having?
What about neither?
Always say it again.
What about neither?
I don't know if neither is an option right now. But
sorry, go on. I interrupted you.
No, it's a good interruption. Let me throw it back at you. How do you engineer neither? How does that happen?
It would have to be like I mean, think about how much these teams. That's the other thing. Lakers are asking for $10 billion. The Celtics got sold for $6 billion. Like, I remember when it was a huge deal when a team sold for $300 million, and that was just a very short time ago, actually.
That's right.
And again, that's where you get to the gambling stuff, which has I think made the finances of this explode. It would have to be in the term of a state intervention, a massive tax. By the way, other countries do this before anybody says this is pie in the sky. A massive tax on buying the team, which would artificially suppress the amounts that are offered. And what if that money went into a direct fund, say, to not only suppress ticket prices, but also do something to the affected areas when a stadium moves into a community? I know that's very pie in the sky, but, you know, we're talking about Western Europe right now.
Well, I love it. And it's not just that it says pie in the sky, because I'm all for pie in the sky. You have to think pie in the sky before you actualize pie in the sky, right? And you're right. It is what Europe, they do things like that. At the same time, how are we going to do that tax if we can't even stop free-funded stadiums, right? Like, we can't even – we haven't even gotten to the point where we're giving free money to these owners and free billions. Like, so, I mean, you feel like that – we have to cross that bridge first. So I'm with it, but we have a corrupt system. But let me add one more thing, DZ. The NBA salary cap was instituted for a reason. I think it was Kevin Garnett got this monster contract. And Dave Stern had a lockout.
Before you say another word, that monster contract was $120 million over 6 years.
Yes, but it was in the 90s, in the 1990s. Right,
fair enough. Yeah. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. So, you know, Juan Soto with the Mets signed a 15-year, $765 million contract. So more than $50 million over 15 years. Not 2 years, 15 years, because Major League Baseball has a free market. They operate with a free market. I would argue that the market for NBA, the salary cap that exists, punishes all the best players. Meaning, like, LeBron on a free market and what he produces is probably worth like $200 or $300 million a year. I'm just being honest. Like, that's what he would go for with the revenue he generates, not just how good he is. He's probably worth it. So LeBron James, in the last 20 years, versus what he's worth, has been the most underpaid player in sports. People don't like to hear that, right? You just find this crazy couch. I'm just telling you from what the revenue he generates.
All right, I'll agree with that. Okay. But LeBron James is not Devin Booker.
All right, I'm going to get there.
With his guarantee of a 34-win season.
Okay. That's a little harsh. So let me get there.
Yeah, really harsh. Chris Paul is there, and they're good. Chris Paul leaves, and they're bad again. Ooh, the mystery.
Chris Paul goes everywhere, and everyone is good. We need to do a show, by the way, because I've been going deep into data. We need to do a show on how Chris Paul makes people better. Like I got the numbers on this one.
So I got some numbers, too. There's a strong case, and it's fine that we're shifting the discussion a little to even talk about Chris Paul, because he just announced that this season, his 21st, is going to be his last in the NBA. And he's coming off a season where he was one of only, at age 40, one of only 12 players in the NBA to play all 82 games.
Which is incredible, because he has a history of not playing 82 games. And at his age, he plays 82 games. And
going out like a soldier, pardon
the expression. Going out like a soldier. And when we do that, I am of the opinion, as great as Chris Paul is, and as he's regarded, he's still underrated, because we underrate everyone who doesn't have a championship. But when I started looking at his Clippers teams and his other teams, and I started seeing, particularly centers, right, the DeAndre Jordans, the Tyson Chandlers on New Orleans, any center that man touched, they just became like 30% better just by him being there. Everyone near him, I started looking at three-point shooters, you know, like Redick's. 3-pointers are 39%. They jumped to 45% with Chris Paul. This dude makes everyone better in a way that, if you're quantifying just only his stats, we're doing it wrong. Are we going to save a show for that, DZ?
Oh, yeah, we are.
Okay.
I mean, if nothing else, in tribute to the fact that he's calling it this incredible career. Yeah. And also, we got to talk about the social justice aspect of Chris Paul's career head of the union. So I know we're running almost done on time. Mike is going to intervene when we need to shut the heck up. But I'll throw it back. Oh, about a minute ago. Well, I'm just saying, Chuck, to be continued on this discussion,
yep.
This is going to sound hypocritical of me, but I actually do agree with you on the LeBron James question. But once we start applying that template to Devin Booker, I start then thinking about the gambling industry, and I start thinking about the parasitic relationship with gambling and how it's hurting our kids and how the profits and then the salaries all trickle down from that. And I also think about the lack of a middle class in the NBA, which means good players aren't finding teams. And all for Devin Booker?
To be continued. I have a lot to say, but to be continued.
Hey, I know you like Devin Booker, but who doesn't like to see a team in 120-degree heat win 32 games?
Okay, I have a lot to say. To be continued.
To be continued. The player who can win you 29 games every year, but he'll score 60 in one of the games. Let's give him $74 million.
Oh, man, I'm gonna really come back with a to be continued. If I get rolling now, I'm going to keep going, so I'm going to stop.
Yeah, let's just stop. And then, but you can be happy because you can enjoy the coming 24-win season that Devin Booker, living inside the inferno of Phoenix, that people don't even want to go outside and go to the games. Yeah, let's pay him 74.
I just want to say, my to be continued. If I knew it was going to be your filibuster, I wouldn't have passed. I would have gone in.
All right, I'll stop right now, and we can all enjoy the 19-win season coming up of the Phoenix Suns. All right, I'm going. I've crossed the line into jerky.
I love it. I'm just going to have to pause and reply. That's all.
All right, sounds good. Next week, we're going to talk. I promise you, listener, we're going to talk about Chris Paul, and we're going to talk about, oh, Lord, Etan is just going to flay me. But I'm going to talk about the salary structure being extremely out of whack.
Okay.
But it sound good?
It sounds good. My last note is Netanyahu's in town. He's being protested every night. Noise demos in D.C. Get that war criminal who's wanted in 124 countries out of here. He should not be. He is not welcome here. And he should be arrested, as you said.
Yeah, like I said, he's only welcome here if he's getting frog marched into a cell. But for now, Chuck Modiano, I'm so thrilled to put on a legend of the radio world. Our interview, you, me, Etan Thomas, with the great, and I mean great, Bobbito Garcia. We are thrilled. We got on the line. I can't believe this. It's always nice to have a legend in the house. We have the author of the new book, Bobbito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong, a memoir of sports, style, and soul. The best book about the New York City playground since heaven is a playground. And I mean that with all my heart, Bobbito. If folks don't know, Bobbito is also a legendary hip-hop DJ. He's a Hall of Famer in that regard. People might know the Stretch and Bobbito show. And if you don't, then frankly, you probably don't know that much about hip-hop. But that's okay. You know, this is an open space. And also the man's game and sneaker world, announcing world. This is the basketball Swiss Army knife. And the hip-hop Swiss Army knife, and the person who showed us, other than Curtis Blow, how it all comes together, the one and only Bobbito Garcia. How you doing, sir?
What an intro. Thank you, man. I'm like, whoa. First of all, amazing discussion that I jumped in on prior, and I appreciate you allowing me platform to join here, and props to everybody in here. I feel welcome. Thank you. And Dave, you know, you have seen specifically the potential of my memoir since day one. So I want to say thank you to you and thank you to Adam Mansbeck, who brought me to Akashic Books, Johnny Temple as well. So, you know, props to everybody up in here. Yo, peace.
So we want to jump right in. I'm just going to ask the first to get it going. We want to talk about B-Ball, Bong Bong, and everything that you tease out of them from the New York City streets. But I associate you so strongly with New York City. And mm-hmm. The book, New York City, is like the main character other than yourself in the book, is New York City. New York City is on the world's mind right now with the overwhelming nomination, now that we know the absentee or the weighted votes, the overwhelming nomination of Zohran Mamdani for the mayor. You got Trump saying he's going to try to maybe look into denaturalizing him and deporting him because of a hip hop lyric tying into you right here on that front as well. MC Cardamon, as he was known. But so, Bobbito, what are you hearing on the streets there? Were people surprised Zohran won? Did you feel that energy? And do you have hope going forward?
I mean, I think I'm always going to have hope as the pressing as current politics may be with the new administration and what's going on globally. But as far as Zoran, I think it's wonderful that he won the ballot in the primary. I think it's interesting, and I'm always curious about why socialists have to sort of undress themselves and revert to a Democratic ticket. Bernie Sanders in 2016 kind of did the same thing with his drive towards the presidency. Of course, it worked in his favor. He caught steam, but ultimately, like, are either of them really Democrats? I almost feel like the whole title becomes meaningless whether you're a Democrat or Republican. In my estimation, in current politics, they sort of operate the same, and they have pretty much the same agenda, which is two different titles. Now, in the New York City case, you know, we're very aware of the history of the success of Democrats, you know, going for the mayoral title. So if that helps Zoran and his campaign, then, you know, then sure, then just, you know, switch titles and call yourself a Democrat. But I would like to see the extension and the expansion of how the U.S. approaches politics with beyond a two-party system. You know, I've voted for the Green Party. I've voted for working class families, party members in various, you know, council and, you know, assembly and, you know, controller and all these other offices that are held. You know, I was even invited to be a contributor to a national campaign to increase registrations for voters for certain communities. I'm going to leave out the name of the organization. But when I was started talking about the socialist, what's the two girls, Claudia and Karina, you know, when I started talking about them in the conversation, they never invited me back. I never got invited back to be part of that, because I was like, what are we doing to, like, if we're going to increase voter registration, are we only trying to encourage people to vote Republican or Democrat? Or are we trying to get people to vote and create another option in this world as we move forward? Because clearly something is not working. And I hope that Zoran can work. And I believe that he can. I know that he's going to have huge capitalist interest working in opposition of what he can achieve. But at base, his platform seems super strong. He has my support, even though I don't live within the five boroughs and couldn't vote for him. But if I was, I would have. And it's, you know, I've always, when I register, I've always kept my Democratic registry so that I could hopefully affect those primaries. And then when I go to vote, I don't vote within my party.
That makes perfect sense. I know we want to get to the book. I'm sure Chuck and Natan have questions, so I want to zip my mouth right now. I do have the follow-up, but I can, on this subject and on New York City hoops, I could ask a 60-minute question. So zip, Natan, you're up, my man.
Well, I mean, I could ask a follow-up on that too, but I do want to get to the book. I'm a fellow Akashic Books author. You know, actually, my two books are right back there on Akashic
Books. There you go. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, props for that. I saw the Edge of Sports catalog, and I was like, oh, I'm going to be in good company.
Oh, for sure. So talk to everybody about Bong Bong. Talk about what that term means and people who might not be aware of it. You know, just break everything down.
Yeah, well, I mean, the title of the book, Babito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong, is playful, as is the cover photo. And that was highly curated in each case. You know, in the realm of memoirs for basketball, it's usually like champion coaches, NBA legends, or, you know, athletes. And I noticed, like, the tone is usually really serious. And my approach towards basketball is, I didn't play in the NBA. I'm not a champion. I'm not a legendary player. Like, I have so much joy, and it provides me such a peaceful state of mind that I wanted to convey that in the title as well as the cover art. So I love alliteration too, Etan. So I just was like, Babito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong. And it's just, you know, Bong Bong is one of the ways when I'm doing play-by-play that I express an action. You know, oh, we got the whip, wop, bong bong. You know, and it's just something I came up with out of nowhere. I mean, in hip-hop, we were saying bong bong. And, you know, if you're familiar with Jamaican music, Toots and the Maytals had bong Bomb Bomb, B-A-M-B-A-M. The sister Nancy had Bomb Bomb. I used to think that they were saying bong bong, bong bong. So that's from my childhood. And, you know, and then becoming like a DJ and a record collector, I was able to own those records eventually. And so, yeah, I don't know really how I came up with the name. It was just playful and just in the moment, spontaneous. And now it's out there. And so Dave Zirin and you know, our boy Johnny Temple at Akashic, they were both like, yo, Bob, like, people are going to, you know, look at the title on various platforms and not really know who you are or what this book is about. So why don't you add a subtitle? And so I came up with A Memoir of Sports, Style, and Soul, because that really felt like it encapsulated what the book is about. You know, basketball is very meaningful in my life at every stage, still is and will be. You know, the way that I was able to navigate those waters in New York growing up with hip hop and sneaker culture being sort of like intersected into how I played the game, you know, style became a very big, important element of that as well. And then the last piece of the subtitle is soul, which to me is, it's beyond an activity. It's my meditation. It's how I'm present. It's how I feel the most like myself. You know, we are living in the midst of a pandemic, an ongoing pandemic, even if the government says it's ended. It's the numbers and the science and the illness. Still, we are in a global pandemic. And I find myself in the midst of all that and seeing what's going on in Palestine and seeing the ongoing struggle of Puerto Rico fighting for its independence. Our people in Hawaii trying to gain some semblance of autonomy again and self-determination. And I mean, you know, on and on. We see what's going on in Sudan and Congo and Haiti and on and on and on, right? And so I consume all this, and then where do I find my outlet to forget about it all for like an hour? It's the park. It's putting up jump shots for an hour, 45 minutes. And, you know, I'm not even getting into my personal struggles with my family and everything else. It's like, that's where I find my peace. And so it was very important to me. Again, alliteration, sports, style, soul. Yes, that made sense to me. But it's really, you know, I think what people can get out of my book is that it's not just a sport for me. You know, it's not even close. Well, it's not a pastime. It's not a casual thing. Like, this is my life.
Yeah. And when you say this is my life, I feel like you are talking, sure, you're talking about hoops and hoops culture and everything that surrounds it. But running through it is New York City hoops as something that is particularly dear to you and that you particularly adhere to. If you were talking to somebody from across the country or around the world about what has made New York City hoops distinct and trailblazing, what would you point to?
I would point to my book. Literally, like, read the 216 pages and the 30 years of my 35 millimeter photography that's featured in all the pages and the spreads. And because I'm not trying to be self-aggrandizing here, but I don't know another book that captures the essence of the city game the way mine does. Now, Rizzoli released a book called City Game, right, which was phenomenal, and I've contributed to. I licensed my photos. I wrote a piece for it. It was edited by William Roden.
Yours is better.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautifully designed. It's incredible. There's The City Game by Pete Axlem in 1970, which speaks to that era. Incredibly done. Rick Tellender, Heaven is a Playground. You know, the In Your Face Basketball book by Alex Wolf in 1980. I mean, you know, there's literature out there that really, like, captures the moment in each case. What my book does is really different is that, and this is not a knock, because Rick Tellender and Alex Wolf are both dear friends of mine, and I am inspired by them. But neither of them are from New York, right? I'm embedded in the community, born and raised. And I can speak on New York from an insider's view. That's also, I'm Latino, I'm raised on hip hop. And so how do those two identifiers inform my experiences on the court, which is very different than someone coming from outside and being like, wow, this is really incredible. I'm going to report on this, or I'm going to document it. And then I'm also a ball player. I'm not just a journalist. I'm not just a documentarian. Like, I'm a respected ball player and I'm an announcer. So I have all these different roles, and there's all this unique social phenomena that happens in New York where these crossroads sort of intersect. And I'm able to express all of that in my book in a way that, in a language that a New York Times reader could appreciate, but at the same time, someone who hasn't even graduated from high school and might have a reading level of just whatever can still extract the passion that jumps out of the page, and they can identify with it. I'm very proud of the project. Mm. Extremely proud of the project. I've done a lot of intellectual property in my life. I've directed 3 films, wrote 3 books, you know, just on and on. But this is particular in my legacy.
I can't wait to read the book. I'm really can't, because I'm a diehard Knicks fan. You know, so I know you got Stephon Marbury in there, and they got all the point guards that came out at New York City. There's a whole list of them: Kenny Anderson, Kenny Smith, Mark Jackson. We could go Ryan Strickland. We could go on. But I wanted to ask you about my favorite Nick when I was a child coming up, that I will almost fight people almost to the death to tell them how good he was. And that is Bernard King. And then, of course, his brother from Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. People don't know. History has not been kind to how good a scorer, how unstoppable a scorer he was. Could you talk a little about Bernard? You could throw an Albert there because they say he was better on the streets coming up in Fort Greene.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have two of the greatest players in New York's history right there. I mean, Albert was LeBron James for the 70s, like bar none. I mean, he was the most highly recruited player out of New York for the decade and perhaps maybe in the country. I mean, his pro career didn't pan out in the way that people anticipated. Bernard King, not as highly touted out of high school, but, you know, All-American, plays it at Tennessee in college alongside Ernie Grunfeld, who also winds up in the NBA from Queens. And then he puts the NBA on smash mode. But my book is not about that. As much as I love Bernard King, and I used to be a halftime reporter for the New York Knicks.
I remember.
Yeah, I've done events with Bernard King, lovely dude, and he deserves all the accolades. My book is not really about the NBA. It really centers on the asphalt. It doesn't negate what the Knicks mean to the city, because in the first paragraph, I open up the entire memoir about my father's sensational love for the franchise and how it kind of dismisses my ability to watch Happy Days and Welcome Back, Kotter in the early 70s, because I'm just a, you know, 7-year-old kid, but the Knicks are on. So the book opens up with that. But my journey is really about, you know, going from park to park, playing pickup, playing tournaments, announcing. Who did I see when my fingers on the chain link fence? And I mentioned a lot of guards that don't make the NBA, you know, who maybe people might know or might not. And I think going back to Dave Zirin's point, that's why my book might be so essential, in that I don't know. And again, I don't know another book out there that it's not just a list. It's like, I tell you about Gorky Ortiz, his importance, why he is part of the fabric that winds up elevating the creativity and that we see on national TV. You know, there's this whole underbelly, this undercurrent that's New York in the 5 boroughs. And it's very particular. It's very specific. And so, yeah, I mean, and I tell people all the time, I'm not a spectator. You know, I'm a ball player first and foremost. If I have 45 minutes of free time in between being a caregiver and a caretaker, and, you know, a freelancer and an entrepreneur, and trying to figure out what I'm going to do in the next 2-3 years to pay bills, right? I'm going to go play ball. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to sit on a couch and watch TV. There's nothing wrong with that. And I love the NBA and what the Knicks do to help motivate people to go play. Because I say it all the time, like, the Knicks made the Eastern Conference Finals. There's more people playing in the parks this summer than last summer, automatically, just by virtue of the Knicks' success. And that's globally, that's just not in the city. You know, if you remember Linsanity, you know, 2012, like, yo, this city was on fire, you know, and I just happened to be on behind the camera that summer making my film, doing it in the park, Pick Up Basketball NYC, or was it 2011? I don't remember the year that Linsanity happened. It was either 2011, 2012, and Kevin Durant, they had the lockout. Kevin Durant came up to 55th and played at EBC at Rucker Park. Mm-hmm. I mean, this city was on fire. So the NBA affects how much people are going to be inspired to go to Extra and play. And people are going to play regardless. But,
For sure.
You know, the NBA is a great marketing vehicle for participation. And let's note that basketball is the number one participatory sport in the world right now. Now, I don't know how legitimate those sources are that determine that. I'm like, how do you how do you figure that out? Like, how do you come up with these numbers? You know, but I mean, listen, I've been to Senegal. I've been to Zimbabwe. I've been to South Africa. I've been to New Zealand. I've been to 47, 48 countries in the world, six continents. And I've seen it with my own eyes, how people are playing ball, how they're approaching the game, the fever that's out there. And so I believe it. And the crazy thing is we have not met our potential. Basketball still has so much space to grow. It's an incredible game to be a part of. 100%. You know,
so let me ask you, let me jump in here. You know, my grandfather would always tell me stories about the playground legends. And he always talked about Pearl Washington. He'd always talk about boys and girls high school. And then he would clarify it was boys high school once. And I guess it wasn't. I always got lost in that because he'd always, I guess they changed it to boys and girls or they changed it.
Whatever. Made it co-ed.
Right. So talk to me about Pearl Washington a little bit and like what he meant to really the playgrounds and just some of those playgrounds legends. He would talk to me about Earl Manigault. You know what I mean? I grew up with all these different stories, but talk to me a little bit about those playground legends.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Pearl Washington, a.k.a. Pac-Man, that's what he was called on the hood. You know, he got known as Pearl Washington, you know, in media. Eventually, and you know, when he was at Syracuse, he was like, I'm saying he was like Elvis Presley at Syracuse.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this dude was like larger than life. I shouldn't say Elvis, but he was Jay-Z to Syracuse. I had the good fortune of being in New York when he was in high school and playing. He was playing in Harlem at Kingdome, and he was playing in the Bronx at Tiny Archibald Tournament and the projects. I mean, Pearl was everywhere. Pearl was like omnipresent because even if he didn't show up, people were talking about him. People were like, and the beautiful thing was that there was no footage, right? So it's all folklore, but it could be backed up because he wanted to become an All-American. He wanted to, at Syracuse, like everything that people were talking about, like, yo, this dude Pearl just dropped 50. Yo, this dude Pearl did an in and out and made somebody fall. Yo, Pearl showed up on a motorcycle at halftime and still dropped 40. Like, you know, all these stories like resonate, right? And Dwayne Washington, may rest in peace. I mean, he did make it to the NBA and he didn't wind up the player that everybody hoped that he would be. But his impact still, I mean, if you look at the Showtime film, Point Guards of New York, I'm sorry, NYC Point Guards is the name of the film. And I'm heavily featured in it as a historian. Pearl inspired Kenny Anderson. Pearl inspired Kenny Smith. Pearl inspired Mark Jackson. Pearl inspired Shamgar. Like, Pearl inspired Rafer Alston. Like, you talk about any point guard that comes out of New York for the next 15 plus years, it's like the bedrock is Pearl Washington. His game was nuts. And let's note, as a ball player, Eton, that he was given license that was kind of unprecedented, right? If we think about college basketball in the late 70s and 80s, the point guard is passing half court and dumping it into the post or starting the play and then basically being removed, right? Like, you be ready to get back on defense. You're like our free safety, right? And Pearl wasn't that. Pearl was like the first option on offense as a point guard. A lot of people think about Allen Iverson being that sort of archetype that sort of changes the role of that position. But Pearl is like 15 years before that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can see highlights of him at Syracuse where he's just going ISO.
Mm-hmm. I love your use of the word folklore there because I really do think that's something like my kids are missing when it comes to sports, because we can see everything on YouTube. We're ranking kids before they're 10 years old. Everybody's got their Huddle website up. And what we lose is the sort of like, hey, there's this guy named Bo Jackson who he's in high school. He can hit a ball 500 yards and he just ran for 600 yards in a game. And you hear these Paul Bunyan type stories, which for me growing up is just part of what
I like,
what made sports just so much fun, because you hear and then you see it. And, you know, that's really part of the joy. So yeah. I'm sorry that I feel like we've lost that. And your book restored it to me. Mm. Like that feeling of wonder, because your tales are about people we may not have even have heard of. Mm-hmm. And they have that quality to them of both fact and legend that informs the game we love today. And frankly, is a bit of a reminder that the game used to be much more individualized, much more free flowing, much more like jazz, much more organic. And I don't know if you agree, but I certainly think that while there's a lot about the modern NBA that I love, there are aspects of that soul that have been sanded down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, going back to Chuck's point earlier, I think while I was, I was a halftime reporter for the Knicks, and then I was on ESPN doing the high school American games, the Elite 24, and I was meeting a lot of, high-profile players and not really being wowed by them in terms of their demeanor or their disposition. And it's like, let's say if I was a tried and true spectator, like, why would I want to spectate people that I don't sense their integrity or their love for the game? Like, a lot of them were just going through the motions or just not people who I would want to hang out with. And that's no judgment on them. But it's just like, if it's a job for you, then cool. I'd rather watch some 10, 11 year olds in the projects dribble the ball off their feet, but they're having joy. And I get that, like, it's a business, it's professional sports. There's a lot of pressure. There's media, there's corporate interests, and, and you're being asked to do like 80,000 things. I don't pass any judgment, but it's just, I'm just like, why don't I watch the NBA game with these dudes complaining when I don't see, of course there's players that express that joy and that love. But going back to your point, Dave, I think just as we look at social phenomena as multiple variables involved, like, I think when it comes to the documentation, the over-documentation of sports in our era, there are some great things about that. For example, Pee Wee Kirkland showed up to Mount Morris Park in Harlem back in the 60s. Mm. He was challenged to a one-on-one game, and he showed up with a briefcase with $10,000 in cash and just popped it on the sideline and just opened it up. This is coming from Pee Wee Kirkland. He told me the story. And he was like, put your money up. Let's play one-on-one, right? So that was an era where, dudes would like hustle and, talk smack and get over on people. But now we have this whole 1v1 phenomena. You got YouTubers, they got like 500,000 followers, 300,000 followers. They're going park to park, they're crashing, they're playing one-on-one, and then they're getting ad revenue from their posts, and they're able to literally like support their family off of playing one-on-one basketball around the world. This is outside of the framework of the NBA, outside of the framework of the NCAA, outside of the framework of AAU. It's its own vehicle. And so to that, I think that's wonderful.
I think it's dope.
Yeah, right. Like, I advocate for that, particularly because they're playing outdoors and I'm an evangelist for people playing on asphalt. So, so the over-documentation in that case worked out in our sports favor. And there's people they got some of these views have like up to 1 million, 2 million views of just a 1v1 game by two nobodies. They were like completely not known on anybody's radar, no top 100 camp, nothing. And they're getting like all these followers and excitement about it. And those people are watching it in the same way I was telling about the NBA. They're getting excited and being inspired to, I'm going to go out there and work on my game so I could be a great 1v1 player too.
You're right. There's a lot of giveth and taketh away with technology, no doubt.
Yeah.
Any last questions from folks? We've taken a lot of Bob's time, and the book is just came out, so I'm sure he's got stuff on the agenda, like going to bookstores and making sure they're by the cash register.
Yeah, I mean, listen,
I'll be doing later today as well.
Talking to the three of you is a joy, and I could, you know, I've been doing a lot of press, you know, for this campaign leading up to the publication date, which was yesterday, July 1st. But I mean, I'm talking to three intellectuals, and your first question wasn't even about basketball, right? And so I can talk in a way that I might not talk to other hosts, you know? So if you want to keep on talking to me, I don't have an out right now. You know, I'm enjoying this.
Good. I have a follow up to your last comment, because you were talking about the one-on-ones, but you know, when we talk about the legend that we remember, we're going back some time, and I'm wondering how much the AAU, a lot of those great players today, they might've been funneled early onto the AAU scene, and we wouldn't have them on the street. So, or at the Rucker, how has the street ball game changed or been impacted by that movement? And what does it look like today?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think if we zoom out, right, if we think about, you know, Eton had mentioned that he heard about Earl Manigault, right? Someone who unfortunately was an underachiever, right? Got caught up in drugs, became a heroin addict. To support his habit, he turned to crime, winds up in jail, right? If we look at Fly Williams, you know, led the country in scoring at Austin Peay in Tennessee, Division I, you know, winds up in the ABA with the St. Louis Spirits, but he winds up turning to a life of crime as well and gets sucked into it and never really realizes his potential as well. You know, he's one of the subjects in the book Heaven is a Playground by Rick Tellender. I mean, and, you know, and this Pee Wee Kirkland, another example, you know, Ray Lewis in Los Angeles. I mean, we can go on about these legends from the 60s and 70s. Billy Harris in Chicago, who, you know, in the folklore realm are like larger than life. Now, if we move forward to the 90s and the last 25 years of AAU basketball, like these squads, for better or worse, are recognizing incredible talent, and they're taking them out of the hood every weekend and going to the Peach, you know, the EYBL in Georgia, or they go into this, you know, tournament, and every weekend those kids are out and they have a lot of guidance, and we're not losing. Who's the last player that we've lost to the street? You know, if we think about Benji Wilson in 1984, gets shot. He's the number one prospect in the country, gets murdered in cold blood, unfortunately, in Chicago. I mean, who's the last player that was supposed to make it that didn't? I don't know what the answer is. I mean, Chris Herron, you know, made it to the NBA, played with Boston Celtics. He was doing hard drugs. He had his quandaries. But for the most part, in the last 25 years, like, the people who were supposed to make it, make it.
Right.
So as much as I might criticize AAU for taking those players out of the asphalt, and maybe the level of, you know, there's been a lot of literature about how, you know, the playground is dying and pickup basketball is dying. It's complete nonsense. It's written by writers who are not from these communities, right? They're like from the outside looking in. Or New York is no longer the mecca of basketball. It's like, just stop, you know? So maybe the elite players aren't in the playground, but that doesn't mean that it's the number one participatory sport. There's masses and masses and masses of people playing ball outdoors now more than ever, literally. And I documented that. I was in 180 parks in 75 days while the making of my first film, doing it in the park, Pick Up Basketball NYC. I can tell you hands-on, there's a lot of people out there playing ball. It's not the 6'8" kid that's, you know, being groomed to play at Kentucky. But just, that doesn't, so what? So what? Basketball doesn't exist strictly for NBA. Basketball is a sport that Dr. James Naismith invented in December 21st, 1891 to be played.
Right.
So we are fulfilling his vision by creating platforms for people to participate.
So I got a question. We're going to let you go. We're not going to hold you too long, but I got you here. But I want to ask this question. So you were the author of Where'd You Get Those? And it was great. Slam Magazine. And New York and NYC Sneaker Collection, Culture, you know, when Dave had his Louder Than a Bomb, you know, Slam is a little different now. And I wanted you to talk about the difference. You know, when you were with them, you really talked about the culture and you kind of brought, it was like almost like an extension of taking everybody inside so they can see what the actual sneaker culture is in the city and what is going on and everything like that. I'm gonna say it moved away from it, but it's just a little bit different. So I'm just asking you, do you think it's different? Do you, I don't think it's changed, you know, but.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, just as we were talking about shifts in movement, I mean, in the sneaker world, there's been a great shift in the last however many years where the reselling aspect of it has really become prominent. I never entered that world for commerce. I never cared about it. You know, I tell people all the time, like when I was on the radio with Stretch in the 90s, we didn't care if an artist was platinum or unsigned. That wasn't our determination. Is the person talented? Oh, word. Okay. He, she, they can rhyme. Let's have him up on a show. So similarly, like when it comes to the sneaker world, the documentation is oversaturated. The releases are oversaturated. The reselling is oversaturated. We have come to a space that was inevitable. Same thing happened with rap music. Same thing happens with anything that bubbles in the hood that's powerful and passionate. And it just kind of like it crosses that level of counterculture. Like I got into sneakers because I was a ball player. Mm-hmm. I wanted functional kicks that would help me be the best player I could possibly be because I'm on the asphalt, right? That was my goal, mm-hmm. right? And then I started customizing my sneakers in the late 70s, early 80s because I wanted to be unique. I wanted to match my sneakers to my uniform, to my Holcomb Ruckel Youth Memorial T-shirt. So that's my curiosity, and that's my drive. A 12-year-old kid now might get into sneakers because he knows he can wait online, he can flip them for double the amount. I mean, in any business relationship, if you can buy something at wholesale and sell it for 100% or 200% markup, you're a great businessman. And 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds are figuring that out. Yeah. And I'm not mad at that. Although I think for me, I'm more curious about the design of the sneaker. How does it help my lateral movement? Was the art that was put on top, the colors, the fabrics? Those are the things that I care about, the design aspect of it, the art. And certainly the silhouettes and the models have been taken out of the space for performance and been raised to the level of art. There's people who buy sneakers don't even wear them. They just put them in their closet or put them on their shelves and take photos of them. And that's not my era. My era, we had to wear the sneakers to get props for them. And so, yeah, there has been a shift, a total shift. I haven't gone along with that shift. Again, I don't pass any judgment for people who are deep into that world and have fun doing that. Cool. That's you.
Well, Bob, you've been so generous with your time. Okay. Thank you so much, man.
No doubt. No doubt.
You're the best. The book, and I really can't say this loudly enough. Let me say the title. The book is called Bobito's Book of B-Ball Bong Bong, a memoir of sports, style, and soul. I said before it was my favorite book about New York City hoops since Rick Talander's Heaven is a Playground. I think I might need to qualify that a little bit. This is one of my favorite books on hoops, period. I'm going to put it in the category of stuff like the Halberstam book about the Blazers is one of my all-time faves. Season on the Brink is one of my all-time faves. Soul in the Hole is one of my all-time faves. Mm. And Bobito Garcia's B-Ball Bong Bong is now in the breath with those titles for me.
Thank you. I appreciate the love. And to all of you, have a blessed day and thank you for your time. All right. That'll be cool.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Bob, for joining us, man.
Hello, WPFW listeners. Summertime is here. Words, Beats, and Life has the event for your family and friends this season. The second annual DMV Made Festival is happening Saturday, July 26th on the National Mall, a one-day celebration of the D.C., Maryland, Virginia region, promoting the intersections of arts and culture, plus health and wellness. With live music by Go-Go Legends, EU featuring Sugar Bear, vocalist Navasha Deya, jazz fusion trio The Mastetics, Black Folks Don't Swim, Kamau, and much more. Plus Family Fun Zone, Poetry and Storytelling Pavilion, Interactive Dance Stage, Live Art Installations, Hands-On Workshops, and Health and Wellness Pavilion. July 26th on the National Mall. Full details at wblinc.org/DMVMade.